another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I think a lot of people out there, I wake up every day and I hit the news and see what the latest mad twist in our increasingly dystopian science fictional reality is. And you know, I've been noticing that effect for many years, that strange warp you feel sometimes when you can't really believe the news that you're reading, a sort of sense that you've entered into some kind of fictional space, some kind of weird dreamlike or nightmarish scenario. And I used to just think that was kind of an artifact of of my overactive imagination, of a lifetime reading weird fiction and science fiction and thinking about alternative realities and conspiracies, etc. But I increasingly feel that it's actually just sort of part of the fabric of our world, as the kinds of forces and institutions and discourses that have held reality, let's leave that undefined for the moment, together, or at least provided a place where we could meet tentatively and agree on a certain kind of reality, are breaking down, and that's part of what we're seeing. Have been broken down, and that we're now beginning to try to navigate in this ever more increasingly fragmented and actively surreal space. And when I say actively surreal, I mean that the mind that tries to understand the world, whether it's through reading news on the internet or reading other things or talking to people or actually going out and looking at things, which of course people do less and less. So I'm mostly talking about our mediated sense of reality, but the mind that tries to understand the world through that is itself being targeted. You know, there's sort of an active confusion of the data stream, a sort of meme war, a culture war taken to a new level of algorithmic intensity and surreal attack, and that's really part of what the scenario that we find ourselves in. And you know, of course, this has been true of nations and states and communications for a very long time. You know, there were biased journalists and 100 years ago, 150 years ago, supporting regimes through lies. I mean, it's not a new story, but there's something about the nature of the internet, the kind of way in which media function in people's lives, our phones, and the intensity of the algorithms that are driving so much of this activity, that adds an intensely surreal factor here. And one dimension of this, that has really struck me, is precisely how much of the rising white nationalism and right-wing presence inside America, inside the media sphere, inside the American mind, is bound up with paradoxically the most intensely radical elements of, or at least aspects of, the kind of radical potentialities of the internet itself, of this new media space. I've been, as someone interested in esotericism, in alternate worldviews and religious views, I've been reading conservatives and reactionaries for decades. I'm very familiar with a lot of the bases of reactionary and right-wing thought, both in its religious forms and its esoteric forms, its longing for the past, for noble heroes, for revealed truths, for tradition with a capital T. This is all pretty familiar to me, and I've tracked the stuff inside of heavy metal and Viking metal and other kinds of subcultures that sort of walk in between, who are tempted by some of these older ways. And that was kind of the sort of reactionary spirit that I was thinking about when I thought about, particularly about young people, you know, about people, you know, in their teens and their 20s, early 30s, what kind of reactionary attractions might they experience? And I always thought of it in terms of the return to, you know, blood and soil, and the way in which kind of paganism appeals to the desire for deeper meanings, for a deeper worldview, for some kind of esoteric truth, for some kind of sense of tribalism. And so that the same reasons that people might practice Wicca or practice paganism who are otherwise liberal and multicultural, it's not hard to imagine why some people would begin to do that and become right wing. And so that's why you see, for example, contemporary heathenism, people who are attracted to Norse mythology and the gods of Thor and Odin, that some of those people are nationalists, white nationalists, reactionaries, whatever you want to call them, racialists in their own terms. And at the same time, a great deal of people who practice the same things, attracted to the same gods for some of the same reasons, are most emphatically not that. In fact, some of them are radical Antifa forces who are directly opposed to these other forces. So all this was kind of familiar to me. But what blindsided me over the last year was the way in which an entirely new flavor of reaction, of right wing, of racism, of racialism, if you will, I don't really like that term, appeared not inside the call for an anti-modern return to the ancients, but rather at the far edge of the kind of ironic, postmodern, nihilistic, snarky, internet culture that have already been familiar with from the cultures of trolling, from going back to Anonymous, which of course featured very different political goals in many ways. And so this new kind of fusion of nihilistic postmodern irony and forms of reaction that have some kind of absolutism, that have these very strong distinctions in them, it really blindsided me, like a lot of people, and has fascinated me and kind of horrified me over this last year. And I think there's good reason to think that the sort of space created by this activity online and the very public feuds on Twitter and a variety of memes that have kind of trickled out of this subculture into the mainstream media who's been covering it, really did have something to do. No, there's no way to know how much with with Trump. And so I wanted to go into this a little bit more. And in my researching, I came across a very, very thorough lecture online given by my guest today, Florian Kramer, a person I've been familiar with for many years, who's been working on the intersection of politics, media theory, art, and especially in Europe. He's currently a researcher at the Institute for Research and Innovation in Rotterdam. He works on new media. He has worked on code and design, issues in codes and designs, and he's the author of Words Made Flesh, Cold Culture and Imagination. And part of what interested me is that he gave a very thorough, he clearly spent a lot of time researching this, but he's also coming at this from a very interesting kind of media angle, new media angle, both the theory and the practice of new media. And so I was just very curious how this alt-right phenomenon, much of which is of course centered in the United States and which takes advantage of the ever-changing logics of new media, particularly the internet, the memes, 4chan, all of the sort of various places that internet culture manifests these days. And so I really wanted to talk to him about both about his findings and about his perspectives on this. So with no further ado, Florian, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, thanks a lot for inviting me over.
And I'm kind of curious, what was it, given that you maybe talk a little bit about the kind of work you normally do, the kind of research you've done before, but what was it that made you decide to spend the, clearly enormous amount of time it would take just to be able to present the kind of overview that you do in your lecture? Like what was it in your own interests that impelled you to go into this sometimes swampy domain?
It was actually very simple because as a researcher, I'm actually affiliated to an art and design school. And there I'm part of a research domain on contemporary visual culture. And we also have a course for our fourth year bachelor's students, which is called Visual Culture. And months ago, I think like already in the summer 2016, I decided that I want to put memes on the curriculum and that I want to talk with the students about memes. And then when I actually had that class, we were right in the Trump campaign. It turned out actually that I, as a 47-year-old guy, knew more about meme culture and particularly alt-right meme culture, which at that time was already eclipsing shortly before the presidential election, than my 22-year-old students. So when I found that out, because I had expected the opposite, that they would be more at home in the subject than I was, then I basically I called my colleagues and said, well, maybe I should make this a public lecture. And we have a public lecture series. It's almost every Tuesday and small scale. It's like 20 people. But then when we announced that lecture with alt-right, and it was right after the Trump election, then suddenly the media exploded a little bit. So we got like 60 people signing up on the day we announced it. And then we decided actually to make a video recording of it. And so it got much, much more exposure than I had initially expected. And indeed, in the meantime, it was really the first time that I did something like real-time research, because I had like 2 weeks between the announcement of the lecture and the lecture itself. And I spent as much time of those 2 weeks as I could reading white nationalist blogs and alt-right blogs. And some of the stuff that I presented was even just were YouTube videos that had been posted a day ago. So. But that's pretty much who I am. I'm someone who, as you, is very much interested in subcultures. And I always think that subcultures are ahead of, let's say, the official highbrow mainstream art, design, media system. So my message always has been that also, let's say, we as an art school should learn from subcultures. And this is, without any doubt, one of the most vibrant and radically and well-networked subcultures of our time. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been spending, I think actually part of the reason that I started to spend more time looking at this material was not just its, you know, political role, the growing political role that was playing in the States, but actually more from my interest in subculture, in particular the way that subcultures use esotericism, whether they're thinking in spiritual terms or not, but how they build layers of secrecy and sort of in how they create an inside to themselves, even as they represent themselves to the public, but also in terms of the use of images. I mean, that's one of the things that's distinguished, right-wing thought for a long, or culture for a long time, is a particular use of images, and we're about the same age. And so we cut our subcultural teeth in a post-punk punk environment when for the listeners who weren't around that point, when there were certain veins of a national socialist imagery, Nazi imagery that were appropriated in very different ways. And you mentioned that in your culture, that at the same time you could have a group like Throbbing Gristle, or even on a more mainstream and earlier level, you know, David Bowie would traffic in that kind of imagery, but as part of a shock tactic, or as part of a kind of a moment of negativity, a kind of critical negativity. And at the same time, there were groups like or people like Boyd Rice or whatever, who were taking up the same kinds of images, but clearly doing it in a much more earnest and authentic way. So there's something about that. There's a kind of current of imagery that becomes really attractive for folks. So I'm curious, this, because you'd work so much with visual arts, how would you say that the role of images, whether we're thinking of memes like Pepe the Frog, which we can talk about more later, but just in general, the kind of image dimension of this alt-right space?
I think this is the power of it, actually. Because if we're talking about the alt-right, we're talking about actually a quite heterogeneous field of different groups and currents. And some of them, you could say, are more traditional white nationalists. So someone like Richard Spencer, for example, who now gets the most media coverage because also he, let's say, in the way he works and campaigns, acts like a traditional think tank politician or political lobbyist and doesn't act like an underground meme creator. He is actually, I would say, rather on the conventional side of the spectrum of that. I mean, I think also that the kind of mainstream media attention that is given to the alt-right phenomenon is one-sidedly focused on people like Richard Spencer and then on people like Steve Bannon and Breitbart. I mean, although they no doubt are important subjects and phenomena to observe and criticize, especially with Bannon literally being in power, it seems to me that, let's say, the real power of this subculture movement comes from the underground and indeed comes from the internet subculture, image culture, particularly memes, particularly image boards like 4chan and 8chan. And everything that you said in your introduction, for example, about heavy metal culture, so what you just said about post-punk culture applies to this as well. And I think also that, let's say, the division is not that clear-cut. You could say that media websites like 4chan or the Encyclopedia Dramatica, which is, let's say, 4chan's version of Wikipedia, but own particular project and site, that they initially stood mostly for the anonymous movement, which you would rather associate with a slightly lefty anarchism, libertarianism, although the politics were never that clear. And you could also say there was lots of kind of fascist visual language in the anonymous movement with the whole kind of vigilante rhetoric. And now, if you look at the same sites, and you see that they almost completely, or 90%, have switched to right extremism. For example, if you go to the Encyclopedia Dramatica, it has completely turned and changed its content into a kind of militant Nazi, fascist, right-wing publication. And you could say, well, of course, it's also maybe the change of that subculture, partly different people having taken over that subculture, but partly it's also the same people.
Right? Yeah, that was it's so funny. You zeroed in on exactly the kind of one of my key questions was, if you, especially if you take anonymous, I think that's probably something that you know, most listeners who haven't delved into the labyrinths of this world are familiar with. And there's clearly so many connections in style and rhetoric and in the actual sites online where this material is gathered, where where anonymous mutated into this kind of meme war alt-right stuff. And that, and then you see you're left scrambling. Is it a takeover? Is it an evolution? Is it you know, it's sort of impossible to know, since you can't really, because it's anonymous. You don't know whether like people have bailed out of anonymous and then a bunch of more people who had more right wing tendencies came in, or whether it's sort of an evolution. There's no way to actually know. But what do you feel? I mean, give it your best shot? Is it something that was kind of already inherent in anonymous, or is it more of a takeover?
Yeah, well, I have one good shot. I mean, nobody knows, as you said, because anonymous is anonymous. And should be said, why is anonymous anonymous? Not because anonymous is wearing the mask, but initially because it was people hanging out on 4chan. And on 4chan, it's one of the last, let's say, uncontrolled spaces on the internet, where actually you don't need to have a user account, and why by default you are anonymous. So just, you know, the people hanging out on 4chan or 8chan, they are anonymous. This is how it all started. And the people now in the alt-right hanging out on 4chan, posting alt-right memes, they are anonymous. So technically, they're the same people. if you accept that anonymous is, first of all, the kind of collective moniker of people on image boards. But that is perhaps a little bit more anecdotal, but there is one really, let's say, one strong case. Only 3 years ago, the Canadian anthropologist and media scholar Gabriela Coleman published a book called Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous. And in that book, which you might criticize for having very little critical distance to its subject, there is a very, in detail, a very extensive portrait of one particular person, namely Andrew Auerheimer, also known under his hacker pseudonym Weave, who back then, let's say, was a kind of key figure in this kind of trolling culture. And he is now actually the key figure, maybe the most radical, the most extremist key figure in the alt-right culture. He is, in the meantime, he is emigrated to the Ukraine. He has a swastika tattoo over his body. And he has helped run, let's say, the most extreme neo-Nazi alt-right sites of the internet, among others, the Daily Stormer. He's closely associated to that. Probably also involved in programming a lot of the Twitter bots. He has also makes a big, living maintaining alt-right websites. So there you have, let's say, the concrete evidence actually of one person who has first been portrayed in the context of, let's say, the anonymous image board subculture, who is now almost, let's say, the embodiment of extremism, of neo-Nazi extremism, and the most radical or most extreme faction of the alt-right.
Why this that's a wonderful fact, and why I think this question is so interesting to me, this question is it takeover or is it evolution? And obviously it's going to be some percentage of both. Is it goes to this deeper question of what kind of, how to say it, how the sort of, I don't want to use the word nihilism in an easy way, but the sort of nihilism of trolling culture, or the sort of like adolescent prankness, the sort of tear it all down, the sort of just thumbing your nose at power at any time someone's trying to make any kind of controlling move, and that kind of resistance, that kind of anarchism, almost in a loose sense of the term, not a really politically focused sense of the term. Whether that creates room for that kind of affect, that kind of feeling of hatred, or that kind of feeling of belief in something like white essence or white identity. I'll ask the same question in slightly different terms. Go ahead.
I think you already gave the answer with your question, because I simply would say yes, and we have many historical examples for that. So, for example, if we look into 20th century avant-garde art movement, and we look at Italian futurism, which was an anarchist movement, which was about destroying everything and creating new image culture, a new visual vocabulary, and that ended up being in that with fascism becoming like the official state art of Mussolini, almost as if history is repeating itself. And it's not the only example. I mean, take Ezra Pound, for example, and that would be another example of, let's say, or even if you take Nietzscheanism, maybe not Nietzsche himself, but Nietzscheanism as a phenomenon, you could say that already was a kind of right-wing anarchist impulse that on about which you could write a cultural history, starting in the late 19th century. By the way, another key figure next to Nietzsche, less known, but interestingly now becoming viral, is
Max Stirner.
German Max Stirner, exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And he has become a meme, right? And the interesting thing about, I mean, Max Stirner, he was, I read him when I was, I think, 14 or 15. This was when I was a high school anarchist. And that was actually the first form of anarchism that appealed to me myself, because I was really, I came from punk. And then I started to seriously read anarchism. And I read Bakunin and others and thought, oh, this is just another form of communism. It's actually very lame. It doesn't have this kind of, it doesn't have the kind of punk quality to it. And then I read Max Stirner, and that was it. And now he's coming back. So indeed, let's say this combination of, let's say, the nihilist, anarchist, destroy everything, impulse can also be a very reactionary impulse.
Yeah, in reading a lot of this material, there's this a point that happens in a lot of these essays, and there's some very intelligent, articulate, playful, almost Nietzschean, not in a philosophically sophisticated sense, but in a kind of rhetorical sense, writers out there in the alt-right. And so I've been, but there's this weird moment where, especially the people who are more the internet side, more the 4chan side, writing about meme wars and meme magic, is that they have this like kind of ironic, skeptical, snarky, punky energy or rhetoric, and then at some point in the article, there's this turn to almost the opposite, where suddenly you're in a realm of like absolute values, of clear distinctions between people, between white people and everybody else, or the sort of heroic values of the strong man, or some what to my mind are very different kinds of value systems. And what I don't understand is whether that shift, or what I perceive as that shift, is even conscious among these people, or whether they just go hand in hand. Like, you get to be a nihilist punk tearing everything down, and you get to be a reactionary traditionalist holding up the highest supreme values at the same time. And I'm trying to wrap my head around this as a subcultural historian, as a media person. So any light you can throw on this, I would appreciate.
Yeah, well, and you know, I haven't thought this through either, so I probably don't have a good answer. But it rather seems to me, I mean, that's almost a kind of amateur psychologist answer, that if you are this extreme nihilist, and then you at some point you reach the point where you kind of throw away the ground under your own feet, right? I mean, that's the point. I mean, at some point, the nihilism becomes self-destructive, and when you reach that point, then you somehow need to stand your ground. And what is it then that you define as your ground? Yeah? And then you have this kind of perhaps atavistic and instinctive and not very sophisticated retreat to very often also completely fictional basic values, or a nostalgia, you know, a nostalgia for a past that never existed. I mean, that's the definition of nostalgia, that it constructs a past that's completely fictitious. So for example, if you look at neo-reaction, which is, let's say, not really the alt-right, but one kind of contemporary school of internet-born, reactionary, philosophical, partly also media theoretical thinking that very strongly feeds into the alt-right, although it doesn't share the alt-right populism. And then you also see I would say it's a kind of switch of people, for example, who very much come from the Silicon Valley culture of post-humanism and this kind of science fiction mindset into fantasy, and fantasy in the sense of the fantasy genre, let's say the Game of Thrones, but also its creation of an imaginary white Middle Ages that never existed in the way that you see in the Game of Thrones. So I mean, if I would be very cynical or very dismissive, then I would probably say neo-reaction is people who have gone from I don't know, from Star Trek to Game of Thrones. make a really dismissive joke. I mean, it doesn't really do enough justice. I mean, they're a little bit above the level of Game of Thrones and Star Trek, but it's basically in that paradigm. Yeah? So I think that's a real problem at stake. So that at some point the nihilism has to stop. Yeah? I mean, my personal introduction, maybe it's a little bit of digression, my personal most impressive introduction into punk was, I think, when I was 12 years old, and I read Mad magazine, so with Alfred and Neumann, and there was this cartoon of a punk band, which very obviously was a satire on Sex Pistols and Malcolm McLaren, and it ended up with the manager basically with the band killing itself on stage, and then the manager stuffing them into trash cans, disposing of the bodies in trash cans, and that was the end of the gig. And you know, when I read this, I thought, you know, this is ultra radical. And then I remember how I first heard a record of the Sex Pistols, I was totally disappointed because it was this boring, bad rock and roll. And I'm like, what's that? You know, it's not people ripping themselves apart. It's completely.
Oh my
amazing.
God, that's real. But actually, that I'm glad you included that digression, because I mean, I'm sure your own political development is, you know, is very complex and has many stages. But in a sort of, because you can understand through the lens of punk and whatever, we all have our lenses, and I can totally get that way. You can understand some of the appeal of the nihilism, and probably can perceive some of the, some of the truths about the oppressiveness of multiculturalism as mediated through, you know, neoliberal media mainstream. I mean, there's a lot of things that the reactionaries are reacting to that are problematic or have become problematic in a wide variety of ways. But I'm just kind of curious for you, like being able to appreciate some of that, how you've come to, in your own mind, politically, culturally, existentially, to think about the role that such nihilism properly plays in culture, in politics, in a worldview.
Yeah.
Is punk just a phase?
Again, I have to use an analogy. Maybe nihilism is comparable to being creative, and I want musicians to be creative, but I don't want bankers to be creative. Because when bankers get creative, or when they think bankers think they are the creative class, then you get 2008. Then you get derivatives and credit default swaps, and you get financial crashes. That's when you get creative book cooking. So actually, I want some form of conservatism, of stability in some parts of society, such as banking. I don't want it in the arts. Maybe that's a very conservative answer. But the same goes for politics. I can appreciate nihilism in a punk band, or also in many other forms, also on the street or whatever. But when the nihilism has become the chief strategic advisor of the White House, then I'm not sleeping so well.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I remember one of the wisest political statements anybody gave me. I had read a lot of political theory, whatever. But I was talking to a British friend of mine, and he was sort of like describing his view, and he just kind of said very casually, he goes, "Well, that's the thing about that. I think a lot of people don't understand about politics is that politicians should be boring, because they, you know, it's like there's sort of this fear of of just getting shit done."
Yeah, and this is also my view as a European. You know, after World War II, after the Third Reich, after the Cold War, I'm very happy with a boring EU. I don't want it to break away. And of course, we now have these nihilist figures who are setting it on fire. And so I would prefer these people. Now, actually. Again, another anecdote. A good friend of mine is the Austrian Swiss artist Hans Bernhard from Übermorgen, formerly from Itoy.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
he's now guest teaching at an art academy in Germany. And they seem to have a program where they can kind of take in students, but then their final acceptance into the fine art program is only after half a year, so they have to go through a first kind of exam. And he had one student who was busy with fascist iconography, with runes and Germanic signs, and all the teachers, they kept the distance. They didn't want him in. Yeah? So when this final entrance exam came, they all wanted him not to admit him. And then he said, "Well, I have to tell you Germans, as an Austrian, the last time that we didn't admit such a guy, it ended up badly." Referring to Hitler, who was a painter. You know?
Yes.
and so maybe this is my very lame proposition. I think there needs to be an ecology of nihilism. And that's also a reflection of my age, that I'm now 47 and no longer 17. maybe when I was 17, I appreciated nihilism, I don't know, in someone operating a nuclear missile. And now at 47, I don't appreciate it that much.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, you mentioned Steve Bannon before, and you know, I started off the show talking about these sort of moments reading the news where I feel like I've slipped into a Philip K. Dick novel, and I had one of those moments, you know, about a week or two, where in the New York Times wrote a piece about Steve Bannon quoting Julius Evola, this, you know, famous Italian fascist who was also an occultist and sex magician, and who plays a reasonably important role in the history of 20th century esotericism. So I'm familiar with this guy, but from a very esoteric point of view, you know, from talking with weird, you know, Gnostic scholars and strange post-punk people, and like it's so far away from reading about somebody who's advising the president of the United States, and then here these things are collapsed. And it just freaked me out. And it freaked me out in particularly because I've studied so much about esotericism that I not only knew Evola, you know, reasonably well, but I haven't made a close study of the man, but I've read some of his books and I get the picture. But more the way that esotericism itself has a kind of place in this alt-right experience. And the weirdest example of that, and then maybe this will allow us to allow you to describe some more of your research, but the weirdest of element of this kind of new esoteric quality is the way that Pepe the Frog, which is probably the supreme meme, or has become one of the supreme memes of the alt-right, is himself connected with the Egyptian god Keck, and it's this whole weird synchronistic story, which we can get into, that has a very weird esoteric side. But before we go into that, I would just love to hear your studies, your research into Pepe the Frog, and how that sort of shows some of the logic and dynamics of this internet-driven alt-right.
Yeah. Well, first before we go into Pepe, a small footnote to Evola. Actually, he's, let's say, the key theoretician for neo-reaction, and particularly, let's say, of the founder, more or less, of neo-reaction, Curtis Yarvin, also called Rothbard, and Evola is really his most important reference. So I see Bannon quoting or referring to Evola rather as a kind of secondhand quote. I rather see that as Bannon having read Rothbard, actually.
That's very perceptive. And, yes, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, and also the question is, to which depth has Bannon actually read these sources? It might be also superficial, but it totally, let's say, it so far this has been, let's say, the strongest indication that Bannon is not just, let's say, superficially connected to the alt-right via running Breitbart and representing the so-called alt-light, so let's say the more mainstream or say less extremist or less white supremacist version of the alt-right, but that he's actually involved to the degree of at least reading up a lot of the kind of standard references that circulate in the subculture. No, Pepe the Frog. Actually, I might not even be the best expert on Pepe, because I think you really have to hang out in image boards seriously and not just as occasionally like I do in order to know all the details and all the intricacies. Well, Pepe the Frog was one character in an independent comic book. That was basically about a gang of college kids, and it had nothing to do. It actually had nothing to do with alt-right culture, and didn't have any political significance. Indeed, the creator of Pepe, the original comic book artist, even went to the media and said, "I want to reclaim him from his kind of appropriation through the alt-right," which of course shows you the whole helplessness, as if we were still living in the 1980s or 1990s. Norway could go to the New York Times and you know, reclaim your authorship or you reclaim your copyright or intellectual property of something you created. I mean, that's completely naive. What happened is that this comic book character of Pepe was then reused on the image boards basically as a kind of emoticon or emoji. So you had the as a kind of smiley. You had Pepe, the smug Pepe with the expression "feels good, man." And then you know, if you were in a discussion thread on 4chan and you wanted to give somebody the thumbs up, then you used that meme. But then it gradually mutated and really like a genetic mutation. You know, that there was Pepe took up a life of its own, and you could say the image board community really took it over and created new variations of Pepe. And a particular, let's say, significance, actually, new political significance, the paper was given in the context of the so-called beta uprising. This is something that I actually didn't originally cover in my talk because I didn't have the time. But the beta uprising is one of the subcultures that feed into the alt-right. And it's basically the subculture of self-identified lonely male geeks who think that they are left out of access to women. Yeah? I really have to put it like that. Yeah? So that there should be a kind of human right to have sexual companions because they always lose to the jocks, to the alpha males. And what might have started as something as a kind of half self-depreciating joke then became actually more serious as, let's say, a serious political demand and something that is also linked to the so-called manosphere, also one of the subcultures feeding into the alt-right, so kind of anti-feminist movement, subcultural movement, when one of the people on 4chan had a personal tragedy fall out and then his posting had Pepe, and then Pepe became the symbol of this so-called beta uprising. And from that point on, it became this kind of reactionary or right-wing or anti-left or anti-liberal, anti-feminist symbol. And then was gradually also taken up by neo-fascists and white supremacists. Although still, you cannot say that Pepe is purely, let's say, a white nationalist hate symbol. It's way too complex. I mean, like,
yeah. I want to stop on that point because I think that's one of the key elements where people like us have a role to play in what's going on. Because I'm very frustrated when I read mainstream accounts of this movement for the most part, because they're not really seeing how complex the problem is. And the word complexity suffices. Like, it's about complexity. It's about the fact that there are multiple perspectives, multiple uses, a extremely heterogeneous zone of usages, and that some of the people, and this is where it gets more complicated, is that some of the people who are using Pepe in order to, you know, foment this kind of reactionary spirit are aware of that complexity and aware that, in a way, when the mainstream just says, oh, the frog is a symbol of white nationalism, that they've seen their own projection, you know. And I saw this very interesting, very self-reflective account of this from a conservative who wasn't an alt-right ideologue, but he was a conservative who was against campus speech codes or whatever. And his analysis of it was actually kind of sophisticated. So it's like complexity is being used against itself in a very weird, very complicated way. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah, but also in a clever way, because in a way you use it almost as a kind of situationist technique to show the stupidity of your enemy. Yeah? I mean, this is, for example, what happened when Hillary Clinton in the last weeks of the presidential campaign then said, well, Pepe the Frog is actually this white nationalist hate symbol. Huh? This is exactly, I mean, let's say everyone in the alt-right subculture has waited for that moment. Huh? That was like the greatest favor that she could have done. And also showing the shallowness of it. I mean, and that's the whole narrative. Like, you are, you know, you are this kind of odd person with all kinds of contradicting politics and views, and you see yourself being misunderstood by, I don't know, your parents, your school, the media, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, but you cannot really pin it down. But then, for example, you start playing with Pepe, and you see the reactions it provokes, and they exactly prove what your suspicion had been. Indeed, and it's very comparable. I mean, again, if we go to our example of punk, let's say the use of swastikas in punk, indeed. Huh? So in the UK, for example, punks wearing swastikas was most of all a provocation of the older British war generation that had fought against the Germans. But then you also have the people who took the swastika seriously, right? So, yeah, just as we said. Yeah.
Yeah, and no, it's very clever. And it's also, at least in some zones, associated with magic. One of the creepier videos you showed, but also kind of funny, was a little how-to lesson from, if I remember the name right, the Adolf Hitler School of Meme Magic.
Yes.
And it was using these sort of magical metaphors to talk about the crafting of memes, after which it gave a sort of very simple lesson of how you grab a hold of a news event, and then you how to visually graft an image of Pepe onto it and try to disseminate it through social media. What do you make of that kind of reference to magic, to esotericism, to the sort of secret side of Pepe and such?
Well, first, a few explanations. I talked about Weave. Andrew Arnheimer, he was probably involved in making that video. That video was also shown in an article, in an interview with him. Yeah? So it's probably one of the things that he did in this whole alt-right campaign. And indeed, Pepe became a sigil of contemporary chaos magic. Yeah? So you could say we have alt-right chaos magic. Chaos magic is something... under that name only exists since the 1970s, if I'm historically correct, but then it has all these precursors, like, for example, Discordianism, which originated in late 1960s subcultures. But if you look at all kinds of forms of, let's say, subcultural and anarchist magic practices, we could also speak, for example, about Aleister Crowley in the beginning of the 20th century. You see that they both had right-wing and left-wing adoptions. And I think a very kind of clairvoyant and good view on that was actually Thomas Pynchon's novel, The Crying of Lot 49. That was a novel written in 1967. And it's a novel about, among others, a secret communication system, a subcultural communication system, where to the end of the novel, it's never quite sure whether it really exists or whether it's just the figment of the imagination of the novel's protagonist. And what the novel does, it describes basically Californian subculture of the 1960s, or counterculture is perhaps a better word than subculture. But that is highly diverse. So it includes beatniks. It includes... people making electronic music, atonal electronic music jam sessions, but it also includes a character, Mike Fallopian from the Peter Pinguit Society, and that's a neo-Nazi white supremacist society. So in this kind of patchwork of complex subcultures and countercultures of the 1960s, Pynchon didn't exclude that, but already shows that this was part of it. And it's the same subculture that gave birth to Discordianism, among others.
Yeah, no, it's a really, really good insight. I mean, I've done a lot of work, research on Discordianism for my current book, and I did a lot of it before I started doing this work, and it was really shocking to see how direct the sensibility, the forms of humor, the formal strategies. How many things connected Discordianism to alt-right meme magic. And then, you have to look at Discordianism and say, yeah, it's a very weird bastard child of a kind of, beatnik, progressive, diverse counterculture and a mutant right-wing anarchism. And so it's like those things are already there. And when you think about California as being a site of so much of this stuff, the Pynchon novels in California, is that the John Birchers, who are as central in the lineage of the alt-right as, as anything in terms of an earlier model, at least in the United States, that was also a heavily Southern California kind of thing. So there's this weird way that California ideology and all contains its own other. And that was a really good point. It's a wonderful novel to point out, the Pynchon book. We only got about 4 or 5 minutes left here. So I know we're not going to go in to be able to do more on Pepe. I want to ask a kind of personal question. One. Yeah. You spent a lot of time reading the stuff. You went through it. You've spent a lot of time thinking about it. How does that, on a more like basic level, how does it make you feel? How do you emotionally respond to what's going on? And how do you think our sense of criticism, our sense of horror, our sense of fascination should be balanced when we bring our attention as researchers, as people are trying to understand the contemporary moment, to something like the alt-right? So it's almost like I'm less interested in the ideological question and a little bit more about the sort of pragmatics of engagement and how you felt even in giving your public lecture about these issues.
Well, what I try to do is also in the lecture and here, look with it from a distance. So I think the facts speak for themselves. And, I don't need to put any kind of personal emotion into that. I think, let's say, personally, what worries me, I may be the personally, if you ask that question, I might be the worst example of an internationalist. And so among others, what I just got, actually, just 2 weeks ago, I got a green card because I live as a German in the Netherlands, and we have elections in March, and there's a good chance that the right-wing populist party becomes the strongest party and that we get a Dutch Brexit still this year, which includes personal worries for me. That if I pull those personal worries back to the alt-right, then I can only say, especially to people in America, and maybe kids hanging out on 4chan and doing some paper and meme magic, you will be screwed over. Because what the alt-right is in America is a completely strange alliance of, let's say, right-wing anarchists and nihilists in the image boards, and people like Richard Spencer, but also Steve Bannon, who basically totally draw on European white nationalism. And a form of the European extreme right that has been in place since the 1970s, the French neo-right, Nouvelle Droite, among others, which is a discourse still not very known in the U.S., which is new, but definitely you will be screwed. You will be as much screwed as, let's say, the brown shirts that went with Hitler and were killed after he took over. A guy like Milo Yiannopoulos, I mean, I don't want to be apocalyptic, but I think he has his death sentence written on his face, and not by the anarchists who did the attacks in Berkeley, but by the right wing, by the real extreme right. So if you think this is just a game, this won't be a game. And the forces that you now support and help to get in power, they don't like anarchism. They don't like punk. So they only use the punk to get in power. And this is the European experience, not just in the 1930s. It was exactly the same in the 1980s. But for example, in Germany, you had right extremist parties that recruited the skinheads to put up the billboards for them or to beat up people for them, But you would know exactly that if they had have come to power, the first thing they would do is shoot the skinheads.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. But that was, and I really appreciate you stepping out of your admirable distance to you know, give a more you know heated political analysis. And I just want to thank you again for doing your work. And I'll put the link to the talk on the podcast website. So thanks a lot for joining us on Expanding Mind, Florian.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Great. Okay, until next week, all you out there, keep your minds open. Mm-hmm.